Welcome to the Ithaca Radio Hour, a weekly program of news, views, culture, and events in our area. I'm your host, John Illingworth. Today is Monday, May 26th, 2003. This week, we have a short report on the Ithaca Fair Trade Fair held on the Commons last week, and an interview with Randall Forsberg, an expert in international arms trade and treaties. First, Linda Farthing reports on the fight for farm workers' rights in New York State.
It was an honor to walk with my core group all 10 days. The bond was beautiful. The people we came across America was beautiful. The reception was wonderful, and sadly, so many of them had no idea that we don't have equal rights. It was great to be able to inform them and to share with them that we are a group that is left out from equality.
Jill McGee helps her husband with his job on a dairy farm in western New York. Last month, she and her children joined with farm workers and their advocates to march the 180 miles from Buffalo to Albany. For the past 8 years, Farmworker Advocacy Day has brought thousands to the Capitol to rally and lobby for equal rights. During the 10-day march, Dolores Huerta, head of the United Farm Workers Union, stopped off at Cornell. The first question I asked her was, what are the most pressing issues facing farmworkers in the U.S. today?
The majority of farmworkers still face the same issues that they faced 70 years ago, which is, of course, very low wages. They don't have workers' compensation in most of the United States, which means if they get hurt on the job, no one pays for their injury. Nobody pays any kind of disability. They don't have unemployment insurance, disability insurance. They don't have collective bargaining agreements or the right to have collective bargaining agreements. No medical plans, no pension plans, and a lot of racial discrimination, and of course poisoning by pesticides. So it's a horrible situation for farm workers. In California, we've been able to make, of course, a lot of progress over the years. And when you think that we've been in existence now at the United Farm Workers for 40 years, and we have been able to, you know, get legislation, but it's still been a big fight because the big problem is that the growers still refused to recognize their workers as human beings. There's still a lot of racism. And even though farm workers have a constitutional right to have an organization, the growers do everything that they can to keep them from having their own organization.
Is there a union for farm workers in New York State?
Well, there have been attempts in the past. The United Farm Workers, we funded a group called CATA for a few years, but then I guess the organizers went into other types of work. In New York State, I think that the groups that are here now, the farm worker advocacy groups here out of Cornell, and then CETA, which is an organization of farm workers, are the ones that are doing this march and are demanding this legislation for farm worker rights. And I worked here in New York City for 4 years on the Great Boycott, and of course came up here to upstate and traveled all over New York and Pennsylvania and New Jersey. And it was always shocking to me, these growers are not getting it, that if they would partner with their workers, this is part of their team. The workers care about those crops, partner up with them, and you have this market that's just down the street, you know, New York City. And yet they were always getting squeezed out by these California growers. In fact, when we did the boycott on lettuce, the New York lettuce growers, I think, you know, got the best prices, and we opened up that market for New York lettuce growers, but they weren't very grateful. They still opposed everything that we were doing.
Every year, an estimated 45,000 people work on farms in New York State. Most are male, and most are from Mexico. Librada Paz comes from Oaxaca, Mexico, and has been working as a farm worker for 15 years. She has worked on farms up and down the East Coast. Taking a break from the march, she spoke to Jesse Lind at Cornell.
How does New York State's farm working law compare to other states that you've worked in?
Honestly, it's a little better than other states. Like, for example, giving a house, that's one of the most important things that they're helping. Other states, you will not be able to find houses. So that's the difference that we have. Yeah.
Wasn't there recent legislation that forced to provide bathroom facilities in the field? Did you work on that issue?
Yes, we got the bill passed. We got the rules, and that's really great. A lot of farm workers still not follow the rule, but at least we got it, and we could demand for that.
So do you want to describe the living conditions of farm workers in New York State?
I mean, I live in that, so I know what it is. You know, I used to live with 10, 15 people in one room, and then one stove, one bedroom, one refrigerator, which, I mean, you can't even fit your stuff in there. So it's like I don't know, you live in, I don't know how to describe that, but you can imagine 15 people live in one room with one of everything, you know, so that's very hard, very hard. And then you gotta get up very early in order to cook, and then when you come back home, you got to take chance to take showers. So, I mean, when it's a harvest time, you got to work over 60 hours because they want, like, everything to be harvested as soon as they can. So they start, like, about 6 a.m. to 6 p.m. or 7 a.m. to 7 p.m., even later. Sometimes a lot of people come back from 8 to 9 p.m., so that's a lot. And then that's usually 6 to 7 days. That's almost every day, so that's very hard. It's very hard.
What is the relation of the farm workers to their supervisor?
That's what they call crew leader.
Right.
The crew leader are directly in contact with the farmers, but the farmers do not have direct contact with the farm workers, so they don't even know. That's one of the things that we don't really like, because the crew leader like to take an advantage. Not all of them, of course. Not all farmers, not all crew leaders are the same. So, but I mean, those who are like don't really care about what the workers do, that's the thing that we try to eliminate. I mean, decrease those things, make the better, have a relationship with the farm workers to the farmers, and that's going to work a better future for that, for both of us.
Rebecca Bixby of the Cornell Farm Workers Advocacy Group accompanied the march into Albany, where she spoke again with Jill McGee.
Can you tell me your name and why you're here today?
My name is Jill McGee, and I'm here because I just completed the 10-day march of 180 miles. I'm here for justice and equality for farm workers.
And do you have experience with farm work?
Yes, in the past I've milked cows on a dairy farm my husband's worked on and helped him out a lot.
Is this your first time at Farm Worker Advocacy Day?
No, I think it's my sixth time.
So after six times, do you see things changing for farm workers, and do you think that this one in particular will change things for farm workers?
I don't see things changing fast enough, and unfortunately I wish it would change faster, because all we're asking for is equal rights, nothing special.
What do you see as the biggest challenge facing farm workers in the fight for equal rights?
Getting Joe Bruno to take charge and do something about it for the farm workers. The assembly passes it, but it seems not to get anywhere in the Senate. I think that's the biggest challenge.
What is your hope for what will come out of this, and what will come out of this rally, and what will come out of this march?
I'm going to stay positive and hopeful that we get overtime and the right to collective bargaining.
And what will you take back personally from this experience of marching and being here today?
Close friendships, new bonds, friendship and bonds that will never end, and a will to keep going and fighting for justice until it's done.
New York State Assemblywoman Catherine Nolan has introduced legislation which includes collective bargaining rights for farm workers, a day of rest each week, overtime compensation, and unemployment insurance.
What kinds of things can people do who want to support the struggle of the farm workers for better working conditions and living conditions?
Well, they have this bill in New York right now, the Farm Worker Bill of Rights, and I think people should write letters to the legislators and say, look, let's get into the 21st century now. Let's treat our farm workers that feed us every day with some dignity, and let's pass these bills to help the farm workers.
You're listening to the Ithaca Radio Hour. On Saturday, May 17th, the first annual Ithaca Fair Trade Fair was held on the Commons. The event, featuring numerous speakers, musicians, and local vendors and organizations, was sponsored by the Sierra Club and Kuslar. The Ithaca Radio Hour was there.
Today, May 17th, is World Fair Trade Day. So it's not just here in Ithaca that we're celebrating this event. We're joined with people from around the world who are celebrating the fact that we have an alternative. The basic principles of fair trade, I'm sure you all know, are that workers get a decent wage, a living wage, in safe working conditions, and that the practices protect the environment. The three basic tenets of fair trade.
Brian Goodell of the UAW.
Statistics from the Economic Policy Institute estimates that the growth in the U.S. trade deficits with our NAFTA partners has resulted in a net loss of more than 750,000 American jobs. The sad part of this is that countries that the manufacturing has gone to have seen conditions worsen, not get better, not improve. Shouldn't workers in other countries be treated the same with the same morality that we are treated here in the U.S.? We need you to contact your representatives and request fair trade policies that reduce the U.S. trade deficit, protect U.S. trade laws, and require inclusion of enforceable workers' rights and environmental standards in trade agreements.
Social activist Lucas Shapiro.
It's not just specialty items like coffee and, you know, kind of organic chocolates that should play into how we think of fair trade. It's really every single type of economic arrangement. It's manufacturing goods, it's a service economy, and it's not just kind of things that are happening in Central and South America and parts of Africa. It's the whole trade arrangement around the world. Who are the people that control the agenda, that set the tone, that are able to manipulate the financial institutions in their favor? So we need to be looking at the domestic economy too. If we're going to talk about sweatshops, in New York City there's over 2,000 sweatshops alone, mostly in the Chinatown region. Certainly things that are made in the United States can be problematic as well. And some of the most profitable corporations like Walmart that's going to be coming to town, they're certainly not accountable to the local economies. And they're making billions of dollars a year in profits without really taking into account all these other issues that I brought up.
Jim Mays of the Sierra Club.
Most of the rules of the free trade movement involve protecting the rights of very large corporations and very rich countries to exploit others, including their own people. How does the environment play into this? A California corporation called Metalclad sued the Mexican government because a little village decided that they didn't really want a toxic waste dump in just on the edge of their town. Well, they prevailed in the sense that they didn't get their toxic dump, but the Mexican government paid $12 million for this. Trade laws are set up so that you cannot have local regulations that, say, create barriers to trade, that do anything that make trade more difficult than necessary. Now, in the case of, say, farming, it would mean that you couldn't ban certain pesticides because they work. They, without argument, they kill the insects. The fact that they may kill the workers is a side effect, and it's unfortunate, but this is a barrier to trade. At the moment, what we're trying to do is to do organizing in communities on the risk that they face from to their sovereignty, to their ability to regulate in the public interest because of the trade laws.
Brenda Rosenbaum of Mayan Hands.
I work with 230 women who are organized in small cooperative groups of about 15 women each in many different areas of Guatemala. And as I said, these women cannot make a lot of money. They're making maybe $30 per month, sometimes 50. They don't make a lot of money, but the difference that I've seen is hope, okay? These women have hope that they can weave and then sell, that the money is gonna come in for sure. What we have seen with these women is that because they're more hopeful and dynamic, they are now looking to establish links with other nonprofit organizations, with people who can help them have a better roof on their homes, all kinds of benefits they have found just by this initial little opening that fair trade has given them, that they have realized that there is hope and there's something they can do for themselves.
That was selected audio from the first annual Ithaca Fair Trade Fair. You're listening to the Ithaca Radio Hour.
The global monster has been forcing its way in. It's got a technique, it thinks it is gonna win. Bring the union, crush dissent and privatize. Okay, it's ready to do business with you guys. Way of life disgusts his arrogance. This lick and sterile world can't fathom difference. But I say to him, my work will be my own, as will my country and my pueblo and my home. Is it fair that free trade is only for a few who stole freedom's meat?
The Bush policy actually has done virtually everything that could be done to promote the spread of weapons of mass destruction.
Randall Forsberg wrote The Call to Halt the Nuclear Arms Race in 1980, which initiated the Nuclear Weapons Freeze campaign, bringing to a close the nuclear weapons buildup between the U.S. and Russia. For the past 23 years, she's directed the Institute for Defense and Disarmament, a nonprofit research center in Cambridge, Massachusetts. In April, she delivered a lecture at Cornell entitled Preventing Proliferation, War, $400 billion military budgets, and Big Brother versus international cooperation, arms control, and the rule of law. We begin with an excerpt from her recent lecture at Cornell, followed by her interview with Radio Hour producer Kay Minix.
They have collapsed arms control, rejected international cooperation, ignored the rule of law in international affairs, retained a huge, unbelievably huge, nuclear arsenal in a world where the United States has no significant military opponent, threatened to use nuclear weapons against countries that don't have nuclear weapons, and plan to develop and produce new types of nuclear weapons, and possibly to test nuclear warheads. So that's actually just about everything you could do to suggest to other countries in the world that nuclear weapons have political and military utility. Nuclear weapons are relied on as an instrument of influence and power. That you may not be safe from regime change if you don't have your own nuclear weapons. And that the very best way of being safe might be to get nuclear weapons, and possibly the only way.
Kay Minix spoke with Randy Forsberg after the lecture to explore some underlying causes of the U.S. foreign and military policy.
I'm here at Cornell talking with Randy Forsberg. First question I'd like to ask you, Randy, is war an industry in the United States just like agriculture or tourism?
Well, unfortunately, I have to say that certainly building armaments is an industry, a rather substantial one. Military spending accounts for about 4 or 5% of the U.S. gross national product, and it employs a comparable amount of people in our country. And there are arms industries and military bases in every congressional district. The Pentagon set it up that way to make sure that if there are cuts in military funding, every district will feel them. There is no doubt that that contributes to keeping military spending a lot higher than it should be and could be.
Do you think there is any relationship between the World Bank, the WTO, the IMF, and war?
Well, I think there's an indirect but important relationship. And that has to do with the power structures in the world. The financial and aid organizations currently are set up in such a way that by collecting interest on old debts and forcing the restructuring of economies to produce cash crops or cash balance of trade, they are disrupting the natural economy of many third world countries, impoverishing these countries, making it more difficult to pay their debts back, and really preventing them from getting out of debt. And I think at this point, it has been actually shown that countries that did not receive aid on these draconian terms, their economies actually did better, on average, over a long period of time, than the countries who did. And that is kind of paralleled in the military area, where the United States is now a single superpower, unopposed. We have a huge military force which is maintained not for defensive purposes, not to defend our country or to defend other countries against threats of external aggression, but to intervene in conflicts and situations around the world with the objective of changing the government or preventing a change in government and trying to influence the kind of economic policies and foreign policy commitments that other countries make. So I would say that both the military in the United States and these economic institutions that are dominated by the United States are aimed at preserving international power structure where the United States first and secondly other industrial countries have the bulk of the wealth and the political and military power, and the great majority of third world countries remain impoverished and are developing more slowly than they might otherwise. Right now, the United States, Europe, and Russia, which are the main arms producers, are maintaining their arms industries by exporting large numbers of weapons to third world countries that can't afford them, and countries that are embroiled in conflicts where this fuels the conflict and exacerbates tensions. In addition, the United States and to a lesser extent Britain and France have foreign military bases and military training relationships with the military in different third world countries, which both enhances the prestige and political influence of the military sector in those countries, and it also gives the U.S. more leverage with their governments, being the supplier of their weapons and their military training. What could be done would be for the wealthy, militarily powerful, arms-producing industrial countries to get together and say, okay, now we no longer have the Cold War. We could move to substantially reduce our armaments and our arms industries and our arms exports and develop a cooperative security system under the UN the way it was originally intended to be, where much smaller forces will help make sure that no small country is subject to aggression by a big one, and to make sure that genocide doesn't go unhindered. But not to do anything else, just to protect against external aggression or genocide.
As the founder of the Nuclear Freeze Movement, why do you think that campaign was so effective?
Well, I think we had a fortuitous combination of things. On the one hand, we had President Reagan, who had some pretty reactionary advisors that were saying some very radical things about trying to fight and win nuclear wars, which is sort of like the current Bush administration.
Can you name those advisors?
Well, Richard Perle was very notable. He's the person who recently was expelled from the National Defense Science Board on the grounds that he was lobbying for a company to export military technology to China at the same time that he was advising the U.S. government. Wolfowitz and Cheney were involved, and Rumsfeld. I mean, this whole crew that's in there now has been involved with the more right-wing Republican Party really from the 70s and coming right up throughout the two Reagan administrations and Bush Sr. But they actually have more influence today than they had then. Right at the same time that Reagan was being elected, the Freeze Movement was really building up momentum throughout 1980 and 1981 at the grassroots level, not just against Reagan, which came later, but against the overall policy of the United States at that time, which unfortunately was to build nuclear weapons of a kind that would make it easier to start a nuclear war. Nuclear weapons that were all over the world, interspersed with our conventional military forces, you know, on a hair trigger, in order to convey the impression that if we ever had another war with the former Soviet Union, it would go nuclear right away, which it probably would have, as a kind of use 'em or lose 'em strategy. So the Nuclear Freeze Movement grew up in response to a very, very an increasingly dangerous nuclear arms race. It was always dangerous, but it was getting more dangerous. So I think it was a straightforward, easy-to-communicate message at a time when things were really getting out of hand. I do think under the Bush administration, we have another time when things are getting out of hand again. And as a result, I've joined together with some other people to have another similar campaign, which is called the Urgent Call, for voter education to let people know in 2004 how devastating the Bush administration's policies have been to this whole web of arms control and other international agreements and treaties.
Forsberg has launched Urgent Call, a grassroots fundraising campaign to stop the Bush administration's push for new nuclear weapons. The goal is to raise $5 million to purchase TV, radio, print, billboard, and direct mail advertising in an effort to educate everyone on the dangers of this new nuclear buildup. For more information, visit www.urgentcall.org.
Do you realize that your country has done all these things in the last 4 years? Is this really the kind of government and the kind of military and foreign policy you want to have? Shouldn't this be an important consideration in the next president and the next Congress that we choose?
The White House has asked Congress to lift the 10-year Spratt first ban on the development of new mini-nukes. The Senate will likely vote next week whether or not to maintain the ban. To make your voice heard on this issue, call the Capitol Switchboard at area code 202-224-3121. Ask to be connected to your senator's office. Calling is the most effective way to get your message to your senators.
You can find this or any other contact information on our show at our website at IthacaRadio.org/radiohour. The Ithaca Festival is an artistic celebration of community. This four-day event kicks off Thursday with the parade and ends Sunday with the Circus Eccentrifica. In between, the Ithaca Festival showcases the performances of over 1,000 local performing artists in every genre. It also features food from a variety of local vendors, a two-day craft show, and many special events. The Ithaca Festival is the largest annual event in Ithaca, attracting an audience of over 45,000 people. $5 will get you your festival button, which serves as general admission to festival events. Complete schedule of events will be posted on the website, IthacaFestival.org. As part of the Ithaca Festival this year, the Sim Redman Band and John Brown's Body will cap off the Ithaca Festival Parade at the State Theater this Thursday. The Sim Redman Band will go on at 8:30 p.m., and John Brown's Body is scheduled to go on at 10. The cost is $12. The Friends of the Library book sale is one of the 10 largest book sales in the country, with over 115,000 items. Books, records, videos, CDs, games, and puzzles, sorted by subject into more than 70 categories. This week, the doors open at 8 a.m. on Saturday and 10 a.m. on Sunday, and until 8 p.m. both days. On Saturday, everything is $2, and on Sunday, the price is reduced to $1 per item. The sale will be held at 509 Estee Street, right around the corner from the Ithaca Bakery. Meet our local feathered friends. This is Cayuga Nature Center's first annual bird show, and they invite all bird lovers and curious people to come out and support their first fundraising effort for the new aviary, Birds of Rhiannon. The event is this Saturday from 12 to 3 at the Cayuga Nature Center, 1420 Teganic Boulevard, and will cost less than $5. Bird-friendly refreshments will be available for purchase. This Saturday, Felicia Farr's female impersonation show will be held at Common Ground on Danby Road. Arizona's Miss Cinco de Mayo hosts a glamorous show to benefit STAP, the Southern Tier AIDS program. Complimentary fiesta hors d'oeuvres will be served from 5 p.m. to 7 p.m., and the show is from 7 to 9. Admission is $5. This week's show is produced by Jesse Lind, Jeff Kirby, Laura Ratzloff, and Linda Farthing. Special thanks to Kay Minix and Rebecca Bixby. Our theme music is an instrumental version of Circus by Crow Greenspun. During the show, we played music from Water Bear and from Colleen Cattell from the Fair Trade Fair. For online information about the music we've played and contact info for calendar events we've announced, go to our webpage at IthacaRadio.org/radiohour. I'm your host, John Illingworth. Thanks for listening, and tune in next week.
The Ithaca Radio Hour is a project of Ithaca Community Radio and is produced at Rep Studio. For more information about ICR, visit our website at IthacaRadio.org. You're listening to WEOS 89.7 Geneva, broadcast in Ithaca by ICR on 88.1, or WHRW 90.5 Binghamton.